This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine for this, the week of May the 12th. I'm Charlie Van Sant for the Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired, CABVI. Great that you stopped by. Up top, the eight dynamics that will shape the election, and that will decide the outcome in November. This is by David A. Graham. Where exactly are we in the election cycle right now? In most election years, figuring this out is fairly easy, but in 2024, it's not so simple. When Donald Trump locked up the Republican nomination in March, reporters declared that the general election had begun. But what's going on is not yet a midsummer campaign, nor does it feel like one. President Joe Biden has started stumping more aggressively and giving more interviews, but he's also been consumed by domestic and foreign crises. Trump's time is consumed by a different kind of domestic crisis. He spends most days in a Manhattan courtroom defending against claims that he broke the law in covering up a sexual liaison. When he's not in court, however, his rallies have been infrequent. Public polling offers some sense of where things stand. Experts warn against reading too much into polls at this stage. And the industry is deeply flawed, but polls are nevertheless the best tool available for assessing voter attitudes. They have for months now suggested a small but consistent lead for Trump, with Biden closing the gap somewhat. A survey Monday from the New York Times and Siena College, typically one of the accurate polls, finds Trump leading Biden in five key swing states. Predicting elections at this point is a game for fools, charlatans, and political strategists, though I repeat myself. But we can identify the biggest questions and dynamics that are shaping the race now and pointing toward how it might look in November. Number one, does Biden fall? Not metaphorically, literally. Voters have consistently expressed concern that both presidential candidates are too old, but the sentiment is especially strong in the case of Biden, the older of the two men. Though little evidence suggests mental slippage on the part of the president, his stiff gait and physical stumbles have created jitters. His commanding State of the Union address helped quiet discussion, but a serious fall or other ailment would thrust the matter back into the center with potentially devastating results. Trump, it's worth noting, faces some of the same risks. He's also very old, and his naps during the trial have drawn scrutiny. Number two, Trump's high floor and low ceiling. In the 2016 election, Donald Trump won 46.1% of the popular vote. As president, his Gallup approval rating hovered around 40, occasionally peaking as high as 49, but typically sitting lower. During the 2020 election, he polled mostly in the low 40s and won 46.8% of the popular vote. This cycle, polls place him, wait for it, in the mid-40s. As of this writing, the Real Clear Politics average has him at 46.1%, perfectly matching his 2016 result to Biden's 44.9%. What years of experience of Trump have shown is that nothing he does can lose him the support of his base, roughly 40% of the electorate, and nothing he does can win him the approval of more than about 49%. His fate, and thus that of the election, is written in those 9 percentage points. How much can he push the number up? And how much can Biden eat into it? Number three, wither or wither the economy. Another thing that seems set in stone, voters simply aren't going to decide that they love Bidenomics, no matter how good the economic numbers look. My colleague Roger Karma has a good discussion of why. A majority also trust Republicans more on the economy, as they have for decades, even though Republicans have presided over economic calamities in 1987, 2001, 2008, and 2020. But how negative or neutral voters feel come November will matter. The economy has continued to add jobs quickly, although the rate of growth slowed in April. The generally solid economy would seem to be good news for Biden and Democrats, except that it means that the Federal Reserve is less likely to reduce interest rates as its board tries to keep inflation in check. Number four, these men and women are nihilists. My colleague Derek Thompson has written about the tranche of voters who just seem to want chaos and upheaval. And the Times Siena poll turns up more information about them. More than half of Americans, 55%, say the political and economic system needs major changes. 14% say it should be torn down entirely. Only about a quarter think Biden would make major changes or tear it down, versus 70% who say Trump would. Voters who think that Biden's changes would be good are in roughly equal proportion to those that think they would be bad. Each about a quarter. For Trump, 43% say his changes would be good, while 35% say they'd be bad. Unsurprisingly, Trump leads among tear-it-all-down voters, but overall the results are a bit incoherent. As I have written, Trump's anti-system pose is a sham. His biggest changes would be to weaken democracy and to enrich himself and his allies. Number five, Biden's status quo problem. Here's the flip side of the burn it all down matter. In 2020, Biden ran promising a return to normalcy after the Trump years. In some ways, he has delivered that. The chaotic White House no longer dominates the news, but in other ways, it has been beyond his control, as in the case of sustained inflation. Either way, voters aren't pleased with the status quo, and as long as the election is a referendum on that, Biden will struggle. This leaves the president in the difficult position of trying to both tout stability and norms, but also promise change from his own first term. The fact is that Biden has set in motion some major structural reforms in the U.S. economy, but many of those changes are either little understood by voters or too slow to have shown up yet. Number six, Judgment Day. With each passing week, the chances increase that the only trial Trump faces before Election Day is the current one in Manhattan on charges that he falsified business records to cover up a sexual liaison. That's good news for the former president, who has managed to stall the other cases against him. The bad news is that the Manhattan trial has highlighted some things that have always made a sizable block of voters nervous about Trump: his lies, his scandals, and his tendency to create drama and disorder. But what effect this will have, if any, is a little murky. Polls suggest that a felony conviction would lose him some votes, but how many is hard to predict. Trump is also dealing with some civil cases. Generally, news about his legal issues seemed both solidify his base and turn off other voters whom he needs to build a winning majority. Number seven, the return of split tickets. Once upon a time, voters routinely split their votes between Democrats and Republicans, but as the two have sorted into homogeneous conservative and liberal parties, and as Americans have become more polarized, ticket splitting is less and less common. Could it make a rebound this year? Well, maybe. The Times Siena poll shows Democrats leading in U.S. Senate races in Arizona, Nevada, and Pennsylvania, even as Biden trails in all three in the same poll. In Michigan, Democrats have made gains in recent years, but Biden looks shaky. In Ohio, Democrats hope that Senator Sherrod Brown can win, although Trump is expected to carry the state. In deep blue Maryland, Republican Larry Hogan, a popular former governor, may have the edge for an open Senate seat. The question is whether voters actually follow through come November or end up closer to the recent pattern of mostly voting a straight ticket. Number eight, the third party factor. Both the Biden and Trump teams seem rattled by the resilience of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s campaign. Kennedy is now polling around 10% on average. Which of the two major candidates he might hurt more is hard to say, and polls have been equivocal on this point. Trump's campaign has recently unleashed broadsides against Kennedy, and Biden's allies have started to pound him too. Even so, third-party candidates tend to fade as the election draws closer, and Kennedy may follow the same pattern. A key question is whether he gets invited to the presidential debates with Biden and Trump. Neither the Green Party nominee, Jill Stein, nor the independent Cornel West will be on stage, but in tightly contested swing states, they too could win enough votes to give Trump victory. David A. Graham is a staff writer at The Atlantic. You're listening to The Atlantic Magazine for this, the week of... I'm Charlie Van Sant for the Radio Reading Services, a division of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired, CABVI. Glad you stopped by. Next up, Jerry Seinfeld's speech was the real news. Why did the media focus less on his words and more on the 30 protesters who didn't hear them? This is by Connor Friedersdorf. On Sunday at Duke University, the comedian Jerry Seinfeld delivered a commencement address that was bizarrely overshadowed in the media by a tiny, non-disruptive protest. Seinfeld gave a compliment and a warning to his Gen Z audience. First came the compliment, "I totally admire the ambitions of your generation to create a more just and inclusive society," he said. "I think it is also wonderful that you care so much about not hurting other people's feelings in the million and one ways we all do that." Then came the warning, "What I need to tell you as a comedian, do not lose your sense of humor. You can have no idea at this point in your life how much you are going to need it to get through. Not enough of life makes sense for you to be able to survive without humor." Seinfeld went on to defend the slightly uncomfortable feeling of awkward humor, arguing that it is not something you need to fix because even as Gen Z improves the world, it will remain a pretty insane mess. "Humor," he said, "is the most survival essential quality you will ever have or need to navigate through the human experience." All of that is newsworthy. Seinfeld is a perceptive observer of life and an undeniable expert on comedy. Plus, as he told the graduates, "I am 70. I am done. You are just starting. I only want to help you." If he is convinced that humor is a crucial salve, "The most important thing I am confident that I know about life, those of us who will never enjoy his success or wealth had really better keep laughing." Yet coverage of the commencement treated something just before his speech as more newsworthy. As the Associated Press reported, roughly 30 student protesters walked out of the graduation ceremony as Seinfeld was introduced. They represented a tiny fraction of the 7,000 students present. Media outlets covered the Duke graduation with headlines like these: "As Seinfeld receives honorary degree at Duke, students walk out in protest." The New York Times: "Duke students walk out to protest Jerry Seinfeld's commencement speech in latest grad disruption." USA Today: "Duke students walk out of Jerry Seinfeld's commencement speech amid wave of graduation anti-war protests." NBC News: "Jerry Seinfeld's speech at Duke commencement prompts walkout protesting his support for Israel." Reuters: "Duke University students walk out on Jerry Seinfeld's commencement speech, chant, 'Free Palestine.'" Fox News: "Watch, anti-Israeli students walk out of Duke University commencement to protest Jerry Seinfeld." Breitbart News: "Why was that the focus?" The war in Gaza is, of course, more newsworthy than any commencement and has been covered extensively. Many protests about the war are newsworthy, too. But the airing of grievances at Duke was not notable for the number of people who participated or for any insight offered on Gaza or for even a remote prospect of affecting the conflict. To the credit of the students who walked out, it didn't even disrupt the speech. So it was suspect, I think, to treat the protest as more important than the event that the activists sought to leverage for attention. A protest in and of itself does not confer importance. Journalists often fail to distinguish between substantively newsworthy protest and mere deployment of the protest mode, a bias that activists have learned to exploit. Social media is optimized to signal boost conflict more than attempts at distilling wisdom, and too many Americans revel in, rather than resist, conflicts. The result at Duke, coverage of a newsworthy speech was informed more than any other factor by the subset of the audience that did not hear it. At least in the midst of a tragic war abroad and a vexing culture war at home, we can shake our heads and laugh about that absurdity. Connor Friedersdorf is a staff writer at The Atlantic. And that's going to wrap it up for our abbreviated edition of The Atlantic for this week, the week of May the 12th. I'm Charlie Van Sant for the Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired, CABVI. Look forward to speaking with you again next week.